The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. And we're reading today from the, I have to look at it, July-August combined edition of Smithsonian. And the story I'm going to start out with is Jewel of the Ozarks. And there's a wonderful picture, either taking from a drone or high up on a mountain or maybe from an airplane. And it has Jewel of the Ozarks imposed over it, and there's a tiny rowboat way down there. A perfect day for paddling near St. Joe, Arkansas. And on the opposite page, horseback riders gallop near the confluence of the Buffalo and White Rivers. Both beautiful pictures. An unabashed tribute to the wild Arkansas waterway that became the nation's first national river 50 years ago. Photos by Rory Doyle. Text by Boyce Upholt. If smoothed out flat, the rough mountain terrain of Newton County, Arkansas, would prove bigger than the whole state of Texas, a local resident once proclaimed to a folklorist. That may be an exaggeration, but the wrinkles of the topography have certainly kept this corner of the Ozarks quiet. Fewer than 8,000 people live scattered across the Newton County's 820 square miles. The place is mostly known for a waterway near the county's western border. A trickling stream grows into the Buffalo River, the first national river in the United States. A distinction it earned 50 years ago. For a long time, Arkansans couldn't agree on what the river should be used for, and some even fought over it. In the 1940s, with the local timber felled and the zinc and lead operations floundering, state tourism officials started promoting Newton County as a wilderness destination. The county was home to nearly half of the Buffalo River watershed, and outdoors enthusiasts considered the mountain stream one of the finest in the region, if not the country. It was a rare, free-flowing waterway, perfect for rafting or canoeing. Some local leaders wanted to turn the watershed into a national park. Others wanted to dam the river, which would provide hydroelectric power and form the kind of placid lake that had spurred the development of lodges, restaurants, and retirement homes elsewhere in the Ozarks. For their part, many people who lived alongside the river opposed both the dam and the national park. They didn't want their farms drowned, and they weren't eager to give up their property for what one of them derisively called a 130-mile-long zoo. In 1965, when supporters of a national park idea organized a canoe race, they arrived to find that someone had blocked the river with downed trees and barbed wire. In a 1966 speech, Governor Orville Faubush, a Democrat who had become infamous for his opposition to school desegregation, voiced his strong support for the formation of a national park. He fondly looked back on his own encounters with the river as a younger man, like a suitor courting a lovely maiden who becomes more enamored with her charms each visit. So was I with the Buffalo River Valley. Faubus's campaign to protect the buffalo was joined by other prominent Arkansas politicians, including John Paul Hammerschmidt, a Republican who began serving in the U.S. Congress in 1967. Hammerschmidt sponsored a bill to make the Buffalo a national river. At the time, politicians of both political parties were taking steps to protect the environment. President Richard Nixon inaugurated the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. The Clean Air Act, passed a few weeks later with unanimous support in the Senate and the only one opposing vote in the House of Representatives. The Buffalo River Bill also passed easily, and on March 1, 1972, Nixon signed it into law. The Buffalo and 135 miles of its banks were now part of a portfolio of landscapes that were considered America's natural crown jewels, including Yosemite, Yellowstone, and the Grand Canyon. The river's westernmost 18 miles were under separate protection as part of the Ozark National Forest. In 1978, the New River Gorge in West Virginia was also designated a national river, but the area was recently converted to a national park and preserve. Other rivers today have National Park Service protection under different names, such as National River or Recreation Area and National Scenic Waterway. The National Wild and Scenic Rivers System, inaugurated in the late 1960s, includes other bodies of water but does not guarantee National Park Service involvement. When it comes to the simple title of National River, the Buffalo stands alone. I first visited the Buffalo a decade ago on an April trip with friends. It was float season, that time in spring and early summer when the upper river is deep enough for canoes. The water, cold and clear, tumbled over gravel bars and curled past craggy cliffs. It had carved a passageway through an otherwise forbidding landscape of shale and sandstone, and limestone, too. It was perfectly contained little wildland, or so it seemed. Shortly afterward, in 2012, Arkansas granted a permit for a new hog farm, which soon opened along one of the Buffalo River's tributaries. The hog waste was stored in large lagoons. If the clay liners gave way or the lagoons weren't properly pumped down, manure could seep into the tributaries. Even if the lagoons held, the manure would eventually be converted to fertilizer and sprayed on nearby fields, which some local residents worried would overload the river with phosphorus. Gordon Watkins, an organic blueberry farmer in Newton County, co-founded the Buffalo River Watershed Alliance, one of a handful of nonprofits that work together to fight the farm. The river is nothing but the sum of its tributaries, Watkins says. Whatever happens in those tributaries is going to impact the Buffalo. The state received a record volume of complaints about the permit, and while there were never any confirmed leaks, inspections indicated that lagoon liners had cracked and eroded, leaving the state's water supply vulnerable. In 2019, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, a Republican, moved to shut down the hog farm, directing $6.2 million in state funds to compensate the farmers. The Nature Conservancy also made significant contributions. Like Faubus, Hutchinson was a self-declared outdoorsman who had enjoyed his own jaunts on the Buffalo River. "I was in law school when I discovered the Buffalo River," he said in a speech, "and like so many Arkansans, I value the Buffalo as a particularly beautiful part of God's creation." Hutchinson formed the Buffalo River Conservation Committee, which brings together state agencies and others to monitor and improve the 855,000-acre watershed linked to the river. Threats remain, of course. Heavy rains carry dirt off unpaved roads and into the river. The U.S. Forest Service has plans to thin and burn portions of the forest near the river's headwaters, which some worry would affect water quality in the river. Summer algae blooms on the river have been more prolific in recent years. The cause likely involves excess nutrient input from agricultural fertilizer and soil washing into the river. All these things that are going on outside the river have direct impact inside the river, says Mark Faust, superintendent of the Buffalo National River. After Faust assumed his post in 2018, he set out to explore every stretch of the river within the park. He finished his quest last year, hiking into a canyon and launching in an inflatable raft, the only way to access the stretch nearest the source. Faust says he expected to find at some point a stretch of water that was less than scenic. He never did, nor have I in many return visits. On my latest trip, I hiked to one of the sites touted by state officials in the 1940s, Lost Valley, where a trail follows a creek up a rock-strewn canyon to its source. After a strenuous climb past a series of waterfalls, we arrived at a tidy cascade pouring from the mouth of a cave, the end of the trail, or so we thought. Then two hikers wearing headlamps emerged from the cave's dark maw. They urged us to go in, so we crawled on our hands and knees through a narrow crevice, lighting our way with cell phones, and reached a 25-foot waterfall hidden within a pitch-black chamber. Thus, we found ourselves inside the mountains themselves, washed in the crash of the cold, dark water where it all began. Now, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the story and read the captions. Wet and still wild, the Buffalo River runs from west to east, from its headwaters in the Boston Mountains in the Ozark Plateau. It flows 153 miles through four Kansas counties and emerges with the White River just south of the Missouri border. And, of course, there are a map drawn of just the river itself and the land on either side. The painted bluff at Buffalo Point gets its pattern from trickling water, its layers of limestone and dolostone built up 450 million years ago. This makes a beautiful wall along the river. A one-room log cabin is one of about 170 structures in the Boxley Valley, a historic district along the upper Buffalo River. And in the foreground is a large National Park Service shield carved out of a large tree, a slice of a large tree, it looks like. And then in the background is a cabin kind of falling apart from age. Kayakers on the Buffalo must time their visits carefully. Water levels can rise 10 feet in a single day, creating treacherous conditions. Sunrise near St. Joe, a missing mining town that fell into decay about a century ago. Today, it's a destination for people exploring the Buffalo River. And another high hollow here. The 210-foot cascade at Hemden Hollow is a popular canoeing destination. It's the tallest waterfall between the Rockies and the Appalachians. And there's three women. I think one of them may be a mom. Let's see. Coursey's Smoked Meats, a family business near St. Joe. Smoking and salt curing are Ozark traditions that date back to a time before refrigeration. And I'm getting a kick out of the prices in the background in their little shop here. Smoked cheddar, $9. Smoked Swiss, $12. Bacon, $9 a pound. Bone-in ham, $6. Okay. And there's a picture of a cabin. Looks sturdy and lit up with the lights along its edge. A rental cabin in the town of Gilbert, along with access to the river, Gilbert boasts a gallery where artists sell their work and teach painting classes. Backing up to the picture I just talked about, Coursey's Meats, Let's see. Yeah. Okay. I thought I read that early, but that was okay. Another caption belongs to a picture of a preacher on the other facing page. Top right, Boxley Baptist Church in Ponca. Though Ponca's population is a mere 30, its proximity to the river makes it a popular destination for visitors. And then the lower part of that page, the Ozark Cafe in Jasper, founded in 1909, is one of the oldest restaurants in Arkansas. Local residents and tourists stop by for live music on Saturday nights. This makes me want to go there. And another, these beautiful rock walls along the river are something we don't see too much around here. There's one single body floating below. No caption for that, though. The Buffalo alternates between stretches of rapid and placid pools. Opposite page, okay, here it explains it. Floating free at Buffalo Point, a popular camping area. This page, the Buffalo gently drifts toward its meeting point with the White River. Our next story, Solving the Ocean. In World War II, victory in the Pacific depended on strategy, bravery, and military might. It also depended on a brilliant marine scientist named Mary Sears. As the Battle of Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands in November 1943, one of the major amphibious landings of the war, as many as 100 boats full of U.S. Marines ran up against a coral reef hundreds of yards from shore. As Marines jumped into the water and tried to make their way to the beach, Japanese fire mowed them down. We couldn't see the blood, but we knew what was happening, Charles Pace, then a 17-year-old Marine from West Virginia, recalled of what he saw from a nearby ship. These men were being picked off by the machine guns. We could see the machine gun bullets hitting the water like raindrops. Still, just 76 hours after the offensive to retake the island had begun, Major General Julian C. Smith and the warriors of the 2nd Marine Division hoisted an American flag up a palm tree in Betio, a bird-shaped island at the southwest tip of Tarawa Atoll. A lot was riding on the operations to seize the Gilberts, which was a crucial part of the Allies' island-hopping Central Pacific prong of attack against the Japanese. Though the United States prevailed at Tarawa, more than 1,000 Americans were killed in the fighting and more than 2,000 wounded, a toll that prompted senior commanders to investigate a question that, especially at this critical stage of the war in the Pacific, would have extraordinary consequences. What exactly went wrong? Between an aerial bombardment that fell short, an uncoordinated and delayed assault against a heavily defended shore, and a shortage of amphibious tractors to get across the reef, there were plenty of missteps to scrutinize. But one major blunder that turned the shoreline into a killing field was shockingly basic. Operations planners, relying on outdated nautical charts and the imperfect memories of foreign officers, had misjudged the tide. Many of the landing craft required a minimum of 4 feet of water to clear the reef, and the operation plan included high tide estimates of 5 feet. But on November 20, 1943, the day the amphibious assault on Tarawa began, an apogean neap tide prevailed. The tide would remain at approximately 3 feet, one of the lowest for the year, and would barely budge for 24 hours. A startling realization dawned on the investigating officers. They didn't know enough about the ocean, and the lack of this intelligence, comprehensive data on tides, waves, ocean depths, bioluminescence, and underwater topography was going to cost lives, ships, and equipment, as the Navy expanded the Pacific campaign. If there was any hope of mastering the seas in time to stop the Axis powers, it was up to the people on the new Joint Chiefs of Staff Committee of Meteorology's new Oceanography Subcommittee, and particularly to an untested diminutive marine biologist named Mary Sears. As one of the few women in the tradition-bound specialty of oceanography, Sears had to surmount numerous obstacles to establish her academic career. Even then, despite impressive scientific credentials, her appointment as the Navy's first official oceanographer did not come easily. Yet, at the age of 38, this unknown plankton researcher found herself in the middle of a terrible global war, providing critical advice to combat strategists, advice that countless lives depended on. Her long-neglected story, virtually forgotten today, illustrates how the nascent field of oceanography came of age and refocused its efforts on the war, and how fledgling amphibious forces grew into premier assault teams. It's no exaggeration to say that Sears, gathering data, making top-secret calculations on the eve of battle, leading her team of scientists and analysts, including the group she called the Enlisted Girls, helped the United States and its allies achieve victory in the Pacific. The eldest of six children, Mary Sears was born on July 18, 1905, in Wayland, Massachusetts, 18 miles west of Boston. The house where Sears grew up abutted lush Heard Pond, where she spent warm days exploring and collecting turtles and frogs. This idyllic upbringing was interrupted when Sears' mother suddenly took ill and died in 1911. In the aftermath, Sears' heartbroken father went to Europe, leaving the children in the care of domestic help, relatives, and friends. At a young age, Sears found herself thrust into a quasi-parental role, maintaining a steady presence for her younger siblings. Sears' fortunes began to brighten in 1915 when she enrolled in the highly competitive Windsor School in Boston. Upon his return, Sears' father married her fifth-grade homeroom teacher. Sears then entered Radcliffe College in 1923, where she managed to find mentors and a new path of study. Most crucially, she enrolled in classes with the prominent zoologist George Howard Parker. After her first year at Radcliffe, Sears dived head-on into the sciences, taking 4 botany courses and 4 zoology courses, as well as Greek and German. Later, Henry Bryant Bigelow, a leading marine biologist of his generation, cemented Sears' interest in marine biology when the two met at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology, and Bigelow offered her a job as his research assistant. He needed help identifying plankton specimens he had collected the previous summer. They would work side by side, beginning a fruitful association that would last decades. She finished her undergraduate degree in biology in 1927 and her master's degree in 1929. Bigelow, instrumental in the founding of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, became its first director in 1930. After Sears completed her doctorate in zoology in 1933, she began working for Bigelow year-round, spending the fall and spring semesters at the Museum of Comparative Zoology in Cambridge and the summers in Woods Hole. Bigelow made sure his young associate met eminent scientists from around the world, forging connections she would maintain her entire career. Still, Sears was not allowed to sail on the institution's main research vessel, the Atlantis, because she was a woman. The prejudice against welcoming women aboard commercial or military vessels was ancient and held that women would distract male crew members and incite the wrath of the sea. Sailors know stranger to superstition, clung to these beliefs, and even modern expedition leaders adhere to this tradition of excluding females. At WHO, which was Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the lack of separate bathrooms for women on the Atlantis was cited to justify the policy. Sailing around the world was how the best oceanographers made their mark. Though Sears had so far missed out on such research trips, she had nonetheless established herself as a major figure in oceanography, specializing in plankton. Eventually, Sears grew tired of depending on male colleagues to bring back specimens from their expeditions for her. For one thing, the men did not always properly label and preserve the plankton specimens they collected. Sears' chance to go to sea finally came in 1941, when ornithologist William Vaught asked her help in analyzing why guano birds in Peru, who fed on anchovies from the ocean, were dying in mass numbers. Sears traveled to Peru, where she sailed around the Pisco Bay and beyond for 6 months on a trawler with an all-male crew. Sears kept a methodical log and collected her specimens. While at sea, she learned her country had joined the war following the attack on Pearl Harbor, circumstances that made her expedition all the more risky. Nonetheless, she stayed to complete her research duties. When Sears returned in March 1942, she found that the war had transformed WHOI. The boarding houses she'd once called home had been taken over by an influx of construction workers, sailors, and scientists preparing for war. The harborside laboratory had been cordoned off with barbed wire fencing, and white wooden guard shacks had sprouted up. The aquarium and the seal pool on her bustling campus, once popular gathering places for summer crowds, were closed to the public until further notice. Returning to the labs, Sears joined a group researching the barnacles and vegetation that accumulated on ship hulls. The buildup increased drag and decreased fuel efficiency by up to 10% or more during long cruises. For ships at war, where both speed and fuel were precious commodities, a solution to the bottom-fouling problem would pay substantial dividends. Sears compiled an extensive bibliography on the marine life that contributed to bottom-fouling, the kind of report that could save the government millions. While Sears spent hours bent over her desk combing through references on undersea organisms, she couldn't help but notice that the hallways were becoming less congested. The crowd was thinning out as men left to join the Navy. She wanted to go, too. And I'm going to have to leave you hanging there. I hate to leave you right here. We've run out of time for Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for the support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. You can hear this podcast, or rather this reading, as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.